Hi there, this is Paul Nagy, and this we're having another edition of Touchstones. And today we have a real special guest, and I don't know exactly where we're going to go in our conversation, but we are going to be discussing the career and the religious point of view with David Halperin, who is a very well-known scholar of biblical and Jewish studies, as well as religious studies. And as are you recently emeritus from UNC?
That is true.
That's true. You need to be a little closer to the microphone. This way it'll get picked up. So, David, you were, you know, so one of the things I thought would be fun to do with you would be to do a sort of, you know, through the decades, you know, religion. So sort of like, so what was your childhood like, you know, religiously, and you know, how did you become a religious scholar?
That is a really, really good question. I was brought up as a conservative Jew. I guess my oldest memory or the strongest memory of what religion meant in my childhood was as something that made me different. Uh-huh. That there were certain foods I couldn't eat, certain things I had to avoid. If I was eating at a friend's house, there were certain days that I didn't go to school, that we did not have a Christmas tree.
Oh, that's a big one.
Yeah, and I remember our neighbors had a Christmas tree, and I was about 6-7 years old. I thought it was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. And the sense that there was something different about me, about us, that could be a source of pride, I suppose, and a source of specialness, but also a source of some pain and isolation.
Now, where were you raised?
This was in Levittown, Pennsylvania.
Oh, so they were probably were somewhat isolated there. That's not a large Jewish community there, is there?
Not in Levittown itself. Now in the Philadelphia area, there was a pretty large Jewish community.
Yeah.
But not where we lived. I think in my elementary school, junior high, high school, Jews were a pretty marginal minority.
Yeah. I grew up in San Francisco, but for some reason I've always known a lot of Jewish people, and I was horrified to discover that that Jews are what, about 2% of the American population?
About 3%.
3%. Okay, you've been profligating there.
Yeah.
But but I'm thinking, gee whiz, I says, you know, for only 3% of the population, I sure as heck tend to know more of them than I do a lot of other people. But I think it might have been general interests that we shared, the bookishness and things like that. So you noticed that you were different. You were an outsider or a marginalized person, which I actually think that gives one of the reasons why a lot of Jewish people are very much into social justice issues. You know,
that could be that we're looking for some way to give a broader context to our own sense of marginalization.
And also the sense that the majority can't tyrannize over the minority, protecting minority rights, and therefore recognizing that other people who are minorities and who are abused by the majority, be it people of color, people of other ethnicities and so forth, you could easily identify with that kind of marginalization.
Yes, certainly during the 60s when I was growing up, that was the case.
Yeah. It does tend to come in ebbs and flows about that kind of things.
Yeah.
So continue with your religion. So that was you as your childhood. Now, you mentioned that when you became an adolescent, you got interested in UFOs.
Oh yes. Let's call that a model of how of alienation.
Very good. So did you ever see one? That's always
no.
You should have taken some of the LSD that all my friends were saying. They saw UFOs all the time.
No, I was a very good boy. I mean, my rebellions were mostly intellectual.
Mm-hmm. How do you remember getting interested in UFOs?
That's interesting. I don't know if you ever heard of a book called "They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers." By Gray Barker.
Yeah, actually, believe it or not, I did stumble across it one time.
It's a very, very remarkable book. I mean,
yeah.
Barker himself, he died in 1984 and was one of the great myth makers
mm-hmm.
of our culture. I mean, he created the Men in Black.
Yeah, that's right. He was the guy that actually created the Men in Black myth, which is, you know.
Yeah.
This is before it was pure pop culture. This is when there were really these guys running around. I remember reading Fate magazine. That was major supply of UFO as well as astral projection and some other happy things. I think astral projection is another form of alienation that's very common that people... Their adolescents tend to go through really out-of-body experiences.
Yeah, well, that one I missed.
You missed that one?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that. I mean, I used to read Fate every month. I remember going down to our local news store and getting the monthly Fate magazine. I don't remember astral projection from it. There was everything else, but I don't.
That's interesting. Maybe that was. We'd have to share the decades. Maybe yours was the early 60s and mine was the later 60s. That may have been it, because there's a few years difference in our ages.
Yes.
It was reading Fate that I got into astral projection and trying to figure out how to fly around in my dreams. And did a few times, by the way.
Okay.
But that's another story.
So that flight and transcendence become...
Profound.
Yeah.
Now, we still haven't quite... You still haven't quite divulged the impetus that turns you into a scholar of religion.
I began to read the Bible.
Oh, wow.
That's
a very radical thing.
Yeah, well, when I was a kid, I read I learned to read from really two sources when I was about 5 years old. One was the comics in the Trenton Times, and the other was the Bible. I think we had a kindergarten teacher who read to us from the Bible, and I came home and told mm-hmm. my mother that there was this black book that they read to us from that seemed intriguing, and she said, "Oh, well, we have one too, and that's called the Bible." Which seemed to me really neat. And I remember my father reading to me from the beginning of Genesis. You know, in the beginning God created heaven and earth, and they did this and that, and there was evening, and there was morning, and there was one day. And I thought, well, this is the book that had the answers.
Yeah, yeah.
And I read a great deal of it even as a kid. And then for a few years, I was actively uninterested in it. And then when I was about 12, I began reading it again. And so, by that time, I'd begun to have a sense of my differentness. And this was the book that explained it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you didn't happen to run into any Christian evangelicals by any chance?
Only my best friend.
Only your best friend?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
So
was this about the same time, too, when you were reading? So you sort of fed off each other?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's fascinating. Yeah.
He would give me, there was a... tract he gave me was something called The Hope of Israel, which was by a converted rabbi, and it challenged if you were Jewish, you could get you could get a prize of $1,000 if you could show from the Bible where Geshlugan Kippurus is mentioned. Now, as it happened, I had never heard of Geshlugan Kippurus.
Yeah, I've never heard of it until now either.
Right. I mean, that it was a practice apparently in some traditional Jewish communities on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, of swinging a chicken around your head and saying, that my sins will light upon this chicken and it will go to death, but I had a life, and I had never heard of
it. So it was a sort of a kind of chicken scapegoatism.
Huh? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
But you were offered $1,000 if you could find biblical proof of Geschlagen Keporis, mm-hmm. and you could get $100 if you found biblical evidence that the new year begins in the fall, which is when we celebrated it, Rosh Hashanah. That right. I knew.
Yes, that one you could figure
that
out.
That one I knew. Mm-hmm. But that was, it intrigued me, because this rabbi quoted from the Bible, and I knew the passage, mm-hmm. which said that the spring month of Aviv, in which Passover falls, shall be the first month unto you.
Right.
So why was it that we celebrated the new year in the fall? And if I could find biblical evidence for that, I could get $100. Well, of course, I never got the $100. He would not have offered it.
Right.
If he'd known, you know, if he hadn't known that no one could take him up on it. And yet it was much later that I realized that in a way there is biblical evidence for it.
Uh-huh.
But in the meantime, there I was reading the Bible, not necessarily in order to win these prizes, but to find out what there was, what was the classical source.
Well, also, another thing that's going on, and it's obviously at least in the periphery of your experience or sense of being Jewish, would have been the Zionism and the state of Israel now is beginning to flourish, and that in itself must have been exciting to at least know about in the offing. What was that? What was that like in your consciousness?
Much less than you would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
My sense is that before 1967, before the Six-Day War,
yeah.
Israel did not occupy the central place that it does now.
You mean for American Jews?
For American Jews, yeah.
Okay.
And we can talk a bit more about why that should have been. But where Israel did impinge on me was that there was a national Bible contest when I was a boy.
Oh.
And that if you won that contest, the first prize was a trip to Israel, and so that was a heck of a summer vacation. And,
that's right.
And as it happened, I did win in 1964.
So you went and did. Were you on a kibbutzim, or where did you go?
No, which I went. I did what was not particularly approved, but I did it. My relatives had some friends in Israel, and they were sort of became my mentors, and I went over there by myself and just learned to ride the buses and learned eventually to hitchhike. Mm-hmm. And I had this totally fantastic thought that I was going to actually learn enough Hebrew to read the Bible when I was over there, but which I never did. But I did learn enough Hebrew to walk into a restaurant and just pick things arbitrarily off a menu and then see what turned up.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Just the joke I would have had was go into a restaurant and order a ham and cheese sandwich. Yeah, yeah, right.
Back in those days, you couldn't do it. I think you could now.
Yes, but, I think so. Yeah.
But you know, you'd offer. You know, I got to say, well, you know, beit zim, these are eggs, and salat yarakot, green salad, and chips.
Which okay.
You know what chips are.
So I assume now that after your summer sojourn, you're reaching college age.
Yes.
Is this true?
Yes,
so,
indeed.
So what did you do when you were going to college? I assume you assumed you were just going to go to college,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. So so what did you do as an undergraduate? What did you study? Where are your interests forming?
Well, I thought I was going to become a writer, which I eventually did, but I was going to be an English major,
right,
so I could become a writer. But I became intrigued. First, I started Hebrew when I started out in college, because although I knew enough to order French fries in Hebrew, I did not know the grammar and did not really know the language. And just as I was starting, they established at Cornell, where I did my undergrad work, a Semitic language major.
Right, right.
And I became intrigued with the idea of learning Arabic, too.
Yeah, well, they're pretty close, aren't they?
Not as close as I would have liked when I was learning that they're certainly cognate languages.
Did you also study some of the other classic Semitic languages, like, I don't know, what Hittite or no, maybe the Hittite isn't one of them, Sumerian and some of the.
Well, I could have, perhaps could have studied Aramaic, but I didn't until much later.
Yeah.
But I had an old school advisor who. His basic idea was, as an undergrad, you learn languages. You don't spend your time doing things like history and stuff, which you can learn allegedly on your own.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure I agree with his philosophy now, but in any case, by the time I finished college, my schedule was Hebrew, Arabic, Latin, Greek.
Oh, fantastic!
So
you were getting, well, that's what you need if you were going to. I guess you'd have to learn a little German and French too.
Oh yeah, which picked up in graduate school. By that time, the dream of being a writer was kind of fading. It had kind of faded.
But if you're a scholar, you're usually right. So
yeah, but it's not the same thing.
Having read enough scholars, I do know. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, my dream was something quite different.
You wanted to be a Gershom, or was it Grisham, the popular novelist? Okay, so you're now, as it were, mired in the classics, classic languages.
Right.
And, you know, so you've read some Greek, you've read some Latin, you've read some Hebrew, and, you know, I read some Arabic. And so what are you going to do with that?
What am I going to do with it? Well, I could become a classicist or as an Islamicist.
Right.
Or a Judaic studies specialist.
Right.
And I took a year off and went to Berkeley, which I think people were tending to do. This was in 1969.
Oh, yes. And yes.
That was where you went in those days. And did something I didn't have much time to do in college, which was that I read an enormous amount.
Right.
And I realized that I wanted to become a specialist in Judaica. And particularly in post-biblical Judaica. And I became a graduate student in Berkeley, had a very, very good time there.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1973, went to Israel this was the second time I was there since my summer trip. And I passed my PhD exams and was ready to write my
dissertation
on let's call it the displaced UFO, the chariot of the prophet Ezekiel, the Merkava.
Yeah.
And got there in August of 1973, and 2 months later, a war broke out, which was probably one of the shaping experiences of my life.
I can imagine it's... incredibly intense being anywhere near a war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was living in a research institute in the, you know, that Jerusalem is divided into a Jewish and an Arab city.
But wasn't after 67 that
after
they...
After 67,
they undivided, at least politically was undivided. It was... But ethnically...
In reality, it was strictly divided.
Yeah.
And I was living in the Arab sector.
Yikes.
And which was not, it was strange. I was living in an American research institute.
Mm-hmm.
It was strange, but not as scary as you would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And that after a time, I felt quite at home there.
At this time, this is younger people in the audience, the suicide bombings and the anonymous terrorism that we've come to associate with hadn't quite started yet.
Oh, you had it.
It
wasn't.
But it was a different style of it.
It wasn't at the nightmare level that it was at. Maybe about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Uh, But yeah, every couple of months. Yeah, and you didn't have the element of suicide.
Yeah.
But every couple of months, yeah, there'd be a bomb. People would take over a school and kill a lot of the kids, or an apartment and kill a family. It was something you were aware of.
Yeah, yeah. So that's 73. This is interesting because I remember meeting a number of Sabras here in San Francisco that were, you know, sort of on Sabras are native born Israelis, yeah. And they were visiting in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I remember meeting them and talking to them. Some of whom were actually one of whom was a veteran of the Six Day War from.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, getting a sense of the incredible ambivalence they had towards the whole constantly being a siege of war. They you know, the ones I met at this time wanted peace, they didn't know how to do it, to go about doing it. And I think that probably, I would assume that that's probably true still with most Israelis. They want peace, but they just don't know how to go about doing it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that they don't necessarily agree with the government's policies of tit for tat, you know, but it's hard to say.
I mean, the way I would have put it is that people have been caught up there for the past few decades, several decades, in a war that everybody hates, but no one has the slightest idea how to stop.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely one of the great pains that the whole world feels in a way, that Jerusalem, this center of peace, is, as it were, completely embattled.
No, holy cities are kind of dangerous places because you've got so many different people attaching so much fantasy
to them. this is true. So a friend of mine used to say, he says, well, about, you know, he says psychic real estate, you can get away with selling off as much as if you want. It's when you attach it to terrestrial places.
Oh, your friend put it exactly right.
It's those terrestrial place names that get in the way.
And then what's really painful is when you get the sacred place and your life is still not healed, then what do you do? The pain is enormous.
Yeah. I remember when I was in seminary, one of the ways that one of my professors, who was doing a sort of survey of the Old Testament, she said, when I really wanted to stop people when they asked me what I was doing I always told them that I was studying Ezekiel. You know, and this tended to always cause people to sort of be taken aback, like, Ezekiel, how can you study that book? You know, it's so full of strange visions and wonderments and so forth. So here you are studying Ezekiel, specifically the chariot vision.
Yeah.
And by the way, I don't think I confessed to you that one of my hobbies is tarot, so... So we take the chariot very seriously in tarot, being, you know, one of the symbols of the major arcana. And usually it means, it has a number of traditional meanings, one of which obviously is it was the, you know, tank of the ancient world. You know, it was the war machine of the ancient world. But here you are, and you're dealing with Ezekiel's vision. And I guess this is sort of the scriptural, license for the beginning of Kabbalah. What's the, in a very general way for anybody who's vaguely interested, how does Merkaba mysticism, this Ezekiel's vision of the chariot, eventually evolve into something? Of course, it takes a few hundred years or more than a thousand to become, you know, Kabbalah.
I would say that didn't.
Okay.
It seems to me that the mysticism that's founded on Ezekiel's chariot is one development. I think Kabbalah has separate roots.
Has separate roots in a separate time and condition. Huh?
Maybe or maybe not a separate time. I mean, Kabbalah is really quite fascinating because it first surfaces in the 12th century,
yeah,
and gets its classic expression, and in Europe, not
in Provence, right?
Yeah, yeah. You got it. First in Provence, and yeah, then it moves across the Pyrenees to Spain,
yeah,
and it gets its classic expression in the 13th century. But I have to tell you, I am terribly attracted to the theories of Moshe Idel, who was one of the most prominent scholars of Kabbalah.
Oh yes,
which is that it goes back to the secret, to secret teachings in antiquity.
Yeah, and of which there are hints in the Talmud.
A few hints.
Very few.
And what Idel argues, you know, I don't know whether we need to introduce Gnosticism to the
Don't worry, I've brought it up.
You've brought up. Okay, good. Well, there seems to be a great deal of Gnosticism in Kabbalah, and the great question is always why? How did the Kabbalists in the 13th century learn the mysteries of the ancient Gnostics? And what Idel suggested, which is absolutely intriguing, yeah, is that the influence is the other way around, that Gnosticism is borrowed from Kabbalah, mm-hmm, Kabbalah being the secret Jewish tradition,
right,
of antiquity, which the Gnostics took and gave it a somewhat anti-Jewish twist. And I am telling you, have you spoken at all about Marcion? And
not yet, Marcion, okay, but I am familiar with some of the Marcion's really an important heretical Christian, yeah, group. Mainly because, for among other things, they held women prophets to be of importance, which is, you know, from the point of view of women's rights, is definitely an important thing to remember. And there's a number of other things that Marcion does I don't remember off the top of my head.
Let me say the most interesting thing he does. He's and we probably should give his dates. He's in the early second century A.D.
Yeah, right.
C.E. That he makes a distinction between the hidden God, the father of Jesus, who is the good God,
yeah,
and then the just God, who is a more or less negative development.
This that is was a, the demiurge. Huh?
The demiurge, the craftsman who was the creator, yeah, of the world. Now, I am reading now, and this is a very well-known Kabbalistic text, which I'm now studying, which, mm-hmm, comes from the end of the 13th century. It's called the Idra Rabbah, and it is a text that sounds just like what Marcion would have written if he'd never heard of Jesus and had,
right,
had only the Old Testament. We have once again the superior good God, and,
yeah,
in this case the inferior but by no means malignant just God,
yeah,
and the discussion of the relation between the two.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the other thing about Gnosticism is that it's a form of religion in a generic sense, rather,
yes,
than a historic sense.
Yes.
That is very simpatico. You look at a lot of secular writers who may never have heard of Gnosticism, yet they construct Gnostic-type works.
Yes.
Kafka. Chris Kafka may have had, yes, other influences. Thomas Mann. You know, again, yes, these guys are extremely well-read, so they could have been privy to the religious aspects. But this form of this, and basically, what would you say are the principal characteristics of Gnosticism in a generic sense now?
I think in a generic sense, the rejection of this world, the sense that there is something evil about it, the sense that we are strangers here, that we come from a superior place, that we've forgotten our origins, and we have to be reawakened to them.
Right. And this, there's many, many versions of this myth. But, of course, one of them is that there's a world negating, that we don't value this world.
Yes.
Right. That this world somehow is imperfect. We can't find it. And, you know, if you look at almost any form of mystical asceticism, there's, yeah, always a thing of saying, withdraw from your senses deceive you.
Yes.
You know, so there's definitely, this is a temptation. And, you know, and it's also a temptation that you need to look into to see if it's, you know, misleading.
Well, yes. I mean, there is some pretty good reason to think that this world is all we got.
And, and, you know, and that the temptation is to too easily assume that, you know, after the rapture, we don't have to worry about this world anymore. And we could have and put it in the waste heap. What may end up in the waste heap is us.
Yes.
And our little slime of biota that keeps us alive.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So, I don't want to actually just go back just for my own curiosity. We're skipping around a little bit in things, but let's talk a little bit about the Merkava chariot vision, just a little bit more than we did. Does that relate at all to a kind of Gnosticism, or in your view, or what would you say are the couple of germane things about it?
Okay. It seems to me there are two slightly different problems. One problem is that the rabbis, the people who were the leaders of Judaism in the early Christian centuries and who created the Talmud and the Midrash, that they seem to regard the first chapter of Ezekiel, the vision of the chariot of the Merkava, as being in some way dangerous. Mm-hmm. The second problem is that you start getting, at some point in the early Christian centuries, groups of Jews who believe that they can have ways to hallucinate trips to the Merkava.
Right, and this is, for people who don't remember, there was John Allegro and mushroom taking. Dead Sea Scrollists or whatever, Essenes or whatever it was. But this goes into the various forms of pharmacies that can lead to hallucinogenic trips.
Yeah. Yeah. I must say, I've not found in the literature of the Merkava any evidence for any pharmaceutical techniques.
But I remember looking at a book by Violet Dermont years ago called The Cult of the Seer in the Ancient Near East. Yeah. There were a lot of other ways that people, according to that thing, there were a lot of ways that people induced vision.
Yeah.
You know, starvation, not drinking water, staying awake for days on end. I mean, if you don't sleep for a couple of days, you will dream awake.
Yeah.
that old MP, those REM sleep wants to come through.
Well, I mean, since I don't think anybody's going to come down too hard on us on this show, I will tell you what I think the modern analog to these journeys is.
Yeah.
And that is the UFO abductions.
This is very interesting because in my days of doing research amongst religious groups, I did have an opportunity to interview a number of abductees and talk about them. And as I used to say, if sincerity meant anything in the world, I said, these guys seem really sincere about what was going on with them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, now where this stuff comes from is a really good question. I think we should, I do not want any of your listeners to misunderstand me. I do not think we are being visited from outer space.
But people feel very strongly that they are being visited from outer space. In terms of, what we can narrative complexity whatever. In other words, they have a good story.
Yeah, and you can read by, like, if you read C.D.B. Bryan's Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, you have descriptions of the hypnotic sessions in which people are induced to produce memories. Now, where they come from is a real question.
Right.
Of their being carried to these vehicles, which are sometimes up in the air and sometimes seem to be down in the earth.
Right. Right.
And they don't fly these vehicles. They're just carried to them. And this is precisely the same sort of thing that you get with the Merkava in the Merkava tradition. So I envision something analogous to a hypnotic situation, probably in a group environment where people are producing pseudo memories, pseudo experiences.
Well, actually, I'll tell you a story, you know, because one of the things I used to do is, you know, hang out in different cults. And I remember I got a friend of mine, and we decided we'd visit this local charismatic character who was wandering through our environs. So this is circa in the 70s, late 70s, San Francisco. And, you know, and he was definitely into UFOs. Mm-hmm. And talked about UFOs all the time, which was not, being I was of the Theosophical Society, UFOs is not high on the agenda of theosophists, but we're open-minded. And my friend was a traveler in India and spent a lot of time in ashram. So we went and hung out with him and his group. And we did meditating. And we meditated, you know. So we were meditating there, and we were quietly meditating. And we did this. And so after the meditation, people started talking about how they were seeing lights around each other. And, okay. they described these various lights and what they meant and so forth and so on. And my friend looked at me kind of curiously, and I looked back at her and she said, well, let's just see where this goes, right? And so we listened and talked. And what was interesting is both she and I were being excluded from this commentary of the various lights and visitations, which were, you know, afterglows from their own abductee experiences. And so they went on about this, about how they